Hey, this is Dominique Henderson, your CFP on YouTube, helping you jumpstart your career in financial services. As always, I'm bringing to you fresh ideas from a recently aired video on my YouTube channel, which you can find at www.youtube.com/theYouTubeCFP. Do me a favor, my friend, and text me at 214-699-7599 with any questions you might have from this show so I can help you along your journey in becoming a successful financial professional. Again, that number is 214-699-7599. All right, let's hop into today's topic. Hey, everybody, this is Dominique Henderson, your CFP on YouTube. Got a very special guest today. I had always been this kind of nerd when it comes to behavioral finance and some element of psychometrics, which we'll break that down in just a second because my guests can do that way better than I can. And I've been following Dr. Brad's stuff for some time. And I just want to really have a conversation today and help people understand the importance about getting risk right with human behavior and all the things that make us make bad decisions, even though we know to make the right ones. So I want to welcome today, Dr. Brad Klontz. How you doing today, man?
I'm doing fabulous. I'm really excited to be here with you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, man. I love these type of conversations. It's always very intriguing to get somebody else's perspective from wherever their money story lies. And that's where I like to start is, how did you get into this, man? What I know you've got a little pedigree here with dad and whatnot, but what ignited the fire in your belly to start going down this path?
Yeah. So I went into school to become a clinical psychologist. So that's what I was doing. I was just going to do my psychology thing. And I came out of school with $100,000 in student loan debt. And I was raised, you know, my mom likes to say we were middle class, except lower. And I'm like, mom, they have words for that. You know, but I was raised they were frugal. So my mom really taught me the value of like saving, actually to an extreme. We're going to be talking about risk tolerance. And she was very risk averse, which was problematic. But I got out of school. I owed $100,000 in student loan debt and I felt terrible about it. And I saw a friend within 1 year make $100,000 trading stocks. And the great thing about this friend is he knew as much as I did about the stock market, which was big fat zero, and he had made $100,000. So I thought, okay, what a great idea. I could get out of debt, right? So that's why I got into the market. So I did what any reasonable person would do, Dominique. I sold everything I had of value, and I put it all in the stock market.
What year was this, by the way?
Well, yeah, I mean, well, let me just start by saying this. I had a great 3 months. And then the tech bubble burst.
Oh God.
And
oh yes.
So then I saw it all start to melt away and I was just like mortified. It was a traumatic experience. I immediately blame my mother because that's what psychologists do. I started to ask myself the question, you know, why would a reasonably intelligent person do something so radically stupid with his money? And so I looked into the field of psychology, like a good grad student. I was doing lit reviews and I didn't find anything, which was really sort of a shocking in and of itself that psychology has basically ignored the topic of money. But that sort of set me on this journey of really self-discovery. And so, you know, I sort of joke about my mother, but I went home and I interviewed my mother and I interviewed my father and I found all these family stories that I'm like, oh my gosh, of course I would have done something so stupid. And to the risk aversion or risk tolerance thing, I found out that my grandfather had lost all of the money that our family had in the Great Depression. So went to the bank one day, sorry, your account's all gone. And he walked away with the belief you can never trust banks with your money, which of course, 100% true back then. Right? I didn't realize this, but he died in his 90s and he never put a dollar in the bank the rest of his life.
Wow.
Pretty amazing. So he was so traumatized by that. So then all of a sudden my mother's anxiety about money and her like not wanting to invest money because she was so fearful, it all made sense. And then my like dysfunctional pendulum swing to being like totally a massive risk taker because I didn't want to be poor like them. All that started to make sense too. So that's how I got into it. And then fast forward, you know, I own my own asset management company now and I teach at Creighton University. But my big focus has been researching the psychology of money and the psychology of wealth.
Wow, man, so much to unpack there. But I think maybe if I can just curate some of what you said, I think that the generational money story that you uncovered is huge, because a lot of people don't even know why they think a certain way about money. You know, it's, let's call it Thanksgiving conversations and holiday conversations year upon year upon year. And then you know, you have your own money or wealth to manage and you're like, I'm going to choose to do this. And you never know where that comes from. What is some of the research led you to with this whole generational money story type of deal?
Yeah, that's really been the focus of my research for a couple decades now. And again, it came from me trying to sort it out myself and then realizing there really weren't a lot of tools out there. So what we've done at this point is we've done research on thousands and thousands of people, and we have found a direct link to your money scripts, which are these beliefs about money that you get from your parents, from your grandparents, from your culture, from your neighborhood. I mean, there's all these influences that basically lead to this subconscious, you know, reality you have around money, which, by the way, is sort of deeply held in there, and it's not examined by very many people, to your point, because we don't really talk about that kind of stuff. So we all have these like subconscious beliefs, like, you know, clanking around in our brains and lead to all these behaviors. But we're left wondering why the heck we did it. So tons of research now on these beliefs around money that you've gotten from your family directly predict your income, your net worth, your financial behaviors, wow, basically your entire relationship with money. So there's a lot of value into doing, you know, what I did, which is looking back. And what I did is interviewing my parents, like, what was it like for you growing up around money? What was it like for grandma and grandpa? And just really sort of be an anthropologist looking into your own family history, because it's pure gold and it's going to help explain your level of success or what things that have tripped you up along the way, which is fabulous information for you if you want to transform your relationship with money.
Yeah. So let's talk about, because what I'm just thinking about in my mind, the visual you gave me was this patchwork type of quilt in our brain. That has, you know, the way that we, you know, it's going to be our financial outcome essentially. And then, you know, people like ourselves, you know, start to work with clients one-on-one, and then they're like, yeah, I did this, or I want to do this. And then you ask why like two or three times, and then you get this treasure trove, as you said, of information. What are some of the ways that you start to find to get this right? And I want to bifurcate between, let's call it, qualitative risk measures, as I kind of learned in Creighton's GRAP program, and quantitative risk measures. Like, what are some of the things that you've been finding that, you know, maybe hit the nail on the head a little bit better than what we've seen in practicum for the last 20 years or so?
Yeah. So this is what I teach in my program at Creighton, okay, which is you have the standardized risk tolerance questionnaires. And of course you're going to have to give those to clients. And they're absolutely terrible in predicting actual risk tolerance, which I know you've seen firsthand in working with people, because they're very susceptible to what's happening in the market. So in a like bull market, everybody's all of a sudden big risk takers. Yeah. And in a bear market, everybody's very risk averse. And then we've also done studies, and some of my colleagues at Kansas State when I was there did this research. It also depends on whether the person asking you the questions is a male or female. And what's so interesting is that if it's a male to female, so consider heterosexual orientation. So if it's a male asking a female or a female asking a male, both genders have a tendency to overstate their risk, their desire to take on risk. It's sort of like I'm a swashbuckling, risk taker. It's so fascinating because it doesn't matter about marital status either. So you could be happily married, but when you're with somebody around the opposite gender, you're more likely to want to show that you're a big risk taker. Just another thing. The other thing too is if you're pumping like financial news in the room, in the waiting room before they come in, that affects their risk tolerance too. So it's not a very stable measure. So just as an example, if you want to get a better, true sort of test on somebody's risk tolerance, there's a concept called risk composure that actually has a lot more value. And so the question, what did you do during the last big market crash? And finding out what they actually did is a much better predictor of what they're going to do next time versus what they state they can tolerate psychologically. The other thing that I really strongly recommend is to try to make the questions more visceral, more emotional. And the way to do that is, instead of talking about percentages, talk about actual dollar numbers. So for example, let's say we're looking at a portfolio that has a potential 30% downside or whatever. So this is a very abstract thing. Like you don't connect with that emotionally at all. But if you instead say to a client, so you're willing to take on this level of risk. So this would mean that you have $1 million and a month from now, that might actually be $700,000 on the downside. So now if you feel like that's going to make you panic and you're going to want to pick up the phone and tell me to get out of all those investments, then maybe we should consider going on a little bit of a lower. You see what I'm doing? I'm making it very visceral. It's like, whoa, okay. And then if you wanted to take it even a step further, this is a fun thing to do. You could pull out coins or Monopoly money and put it on the table and sort of demonstrate what that loss would be and take that 30% and actually dump it in the garbage, you know, something sort of dramatic. Because you're really going to get you're going to get a much better and more accurate risk tolerance assessment by doing something like that. And you're also sort of inoculating a client to the reality that might happen over time. And again, I always end that with, so if you feel like you're going to pick up the phone and want us to like lock in all those losses, then we should probably go more conservative.
Yeah, man. So there's a lot of things here. Cause I think historically our environment, our industry has taken or put more weight on the quantitative part of it. Because it's the easiest to gather, right? It's, you know, give me your documents, your statements, you know, take this 6 or 20, you know, question, risk tolerance questionnaire. But to be honest, at least from what you're saying and what I know from working with clients is the qualitative part where you're actually having a conversation, you're giving examples is the more substantive. And not to say it's going to avoid them, you know, from the pain of when the market goes down, but at least you say you're inoculating them to some degree, which brings up another point, because we've got a lot of technology and automation and digitization coming, and there are, I'm not going to name any names, but we got all the robos out there that are collecting all these assets. And to be honest, and I've tried some of them, there's like a 6-question RTQ, right? Risk tolerance questionnaire that says, okay, you should be in this basket or this asset allocation. Like, how dangerous do you think that is based on the research you've had?
Well, I mean, I feel like there was a glitch a couple of years back, and I don't remember all the details, but I know the robo advisor got into a little bit of trouble because the market was tanking and everyone wanted to sell out. And so I think it's just another example of sort of that risk tolerance questionnaire. We have to give it. And actually, there's some valuable information, or at least getting that person's snapshot, like right now, emotionally, how they're picturing themselves. So, and that's valuable information. But I think it's really important to understand that that's might not have anything to do with how they actually behave.
It's likely that it will not.
Yes, exactly. And especially if they've never experienced a down market. And what's so interesting is we have an entire generation of investors that have actually never experienced a down market, you know, in the last 10 years or so. So I think that it's an important piece of information, but it's only one piece of the puzzle. And that conversation and asking about history and getting to know your client better and making it more visceral and more real, it's just going to help in terms of your relationship with the client. You know, one of the more dangerous, and I say dangerous plus an opportunity, is around clients in a downward market. And advisors who had sort of hidden the downside, which is very tempting to do, especially if you're a new advisor. You know, you don't want to talk about the downside. You want them to feel good and you want to talk about the upside. And that's why they're actually they're hiring you, right? They want to do better than they would otherwise. So the danger, though, I think, is sort of minimizing and downplaying that downside. And then when it hits, you know, clients might feel betrayed. They might feel like you didn't do a good job. And so I think it's really important to actually accentuate the downside of that potential swing.
No, it's a good point. I mean, that's reminding me of the fairness doctrine in the CFP curriculum, right? Where it's just you're presenting both sides just so that you don't necessarily get them to, you know, give you an answer that they wouldn't otherwise give if they didn't know the information. Hey, Dominique here, and I hope you are really enjoying this week's episode. Look, if you're a current or aspiring financial professional and you'd like to join a community of like-minded individuals that I'm sharing my 20 plus years of experience with, make sure you visit my website at www.djh-capital.com for more information. Now back to this week's episode. And I don't know, you're probably familiar with Dan Ariely's research, the predictably. I just read Predictably Irrational, which you're covering a lot of the stones he rolled over with. You know, I get choice A, choice B. I know choice A is right, but I choose choice B all the time. And there's no rhyme or reason behind that, except for some of the stuff that you've said about underlying stories and whatnot. So I'm curious, what do you envision? And maybe you can point my aspiring financial professional audience to some studies or some books or even research, white papers or whatnot, that kind of give us a more complete or comprehensive spectrum on how to consider risk, right? So we got to RTQ, right? And then you mentioned some things about risk composure. So kind of unveil your tool belt for how we would look at this.
Sure. So risk composure, there are some scales that cover it, but I wouldn't necessarily have, I wouldn't suggest you go dig around and find those. I think the question is, what did you do in the last market downturn? Okay. And to find out behaviorally, because the best predictor of future behavior is past behavior. And so if they said, well, I was, I got really afraid, but I just sort of held to my guns, that's showing you some pretty good risk composure, which is probably going to predict that they're, so they did that and obviously things got better and they held, so they were able to enjoy the gains. That's going to give you a pretty good picture that they're going to do the same thing next time. If they told you, oh, I went all the cash and I've been all the cash for the last 10 years, should I go all in the market right now? that's actually a big, huge red flag that, they might want to be taking on way more risk than they actually can handle psychologically, and it's going to damage them. So risk composure, just with that one question, what did you do in the last market downturn? And having them talk about that experience. I mean, that is just so incredibly valuable.
It reminds me of the Kahneman research with the prospect theory, where, we're twice as much concerned about the downside than the upside, because some new advisor may ask, like, well, why not ask them the converse question about the upside? And it's just because of how we're made up as humans. Would you agree to ask about the downside?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And so that loss is going to have like two or three times the impact of missing out on a potential gain. And so that's always something to consider, because when you're sitting with a client, again, you're going to be tempted to sort of, sell your upside, and this is what we've done for clients, that kind of thing. And it's always really dangerous to, if you're going to sell on your returns, you're going to die on your returns, right? So that's just sort of some cautionary advice. And you also can't really control that aspect, right? So I think it's a good idea to just conceptually be thinking about that, because it's a tough conversation, right? And so you want clients to feel good. So I understand why we have a tendency to avoid it. And to your point about all the behavioral finance research, I think to sum all that up, I think that it's really important to know that we're all wired to do the absolute wrong thing around our money and around the markets. And one of the ways I like to look at it is looking at our brains as very much being a tribal brain. And so we have a brain that has really been designed to function about 2,000 years ago in small tribes of 150, 200 related people. And we're ideally suited for that. And so, for example, you can't save money in that type of an environment. Actually, you'd be shunned by the other people in your tribe if you were this selfish hoarder of resources. And so we actually have to overcome a natural inhibition to save. So that's interesting, right? It also explains why a lot of Americans aren't good savers. We're sort of wired to not do it. Same thing, as being extremely skittish when the market is starting to drop. We're sort of herd. We have a herd mentality. The worst thing that could have happened to our ancestors, and we wouldn't be right here right now if this had happened to our ancestors, that would have been for them to be abandoned by the tribe. So they stay here, and the tribe or the herd goes off over here. We have a natural panic that happens. Some people talk about it as greed. I see it more as fear. And so we fear of missing out, fear of being left alone. And so this is why you see these market cycles that are just going to absolutely continue, where people do the absolute wrong thing. They sell at the bottom, they buy at the top. And it's because of this tribal sort of emotional brain that we have to basically suppress in order to do the right things.
Yeah, my brain just went on a tangent. It was like, I wonder why, sometimes investment clubs do so well, like where you get like 10 or 15 older women or something like that, and they're all, you know, going back and forth with the research. Some of those perform really well, and it's probably because of what you just named. You know, you don't have this person all on one island trying to do their own research, which is the next question I was going to ask you is, like, we have this, I would say, barrage of information. Everything's at your fingertips. You can literally Google it. I, for the longest, have maintained, and I may be wrong, but I think there's probably maybe 1% of the population that can actually do it on their own, because there's just so much inherent bias with consulting yourself. You know, I'm a financial advisor with a financial advisor. So I'm curious on what you kind of, A, think about the scope of financial advice with a practitioner like ourselves, or practitioners like ourselves, to the, you know, the consumer financial services, whether you think that's needful. And then B, what do you see the future of this industry going towards, as far as how that relationship shapes out?
Well, Dominique, I want to go back to your investment club example, because that example you used, they also had the advantage of being women. And very, very clear, and you, I'm sure you're familiar with this too, but very clear research that women outperform men in terms of investing. And what they've nailed it down to is one factor. And so this is, and by the way, you can correct this if you're a male, and I hope you do, but it's that sense of overconfidence. So it's overconfidence that actually leads to lower returns, which is fascinating. Yeah. So yeah, the more you think you know what you're doing, and the more you think you're on top of it,
worse off.
The more you think you know what's happening next in the market, oh yeah, the worse it's going to be for you.
So, well, let me parenthetically say that the financial advisor that I have was my wife's idea.
Well, of course, yes. And I do want to, you know, that's another thing that I think is really important to touch on. So I am CFP, you know, I'm a professor in finance and all this, and I don't make my own investment decisions. Are you kidding me? That's my money. I'm emotionally attached to that. I will do all the wrong things. And so, you know, we use very strict quantitative models, and we have a whole team. And if you don't have an advisor, you should get one. And there's been tons of studies done on this too. Like, advisors are just as vulnerable to this also.
Even more so.
Yes. Yeah. Well, even more so, because it's not just your money. It's your mom's money. It's your sister's money. It's all your friends' money. It's people you love's money that you're managing. So the stakes are much, much higher. And actually, I did a study back in the last the Great Recession on post-traumatic stress in financial planners. Because I was, you know, as a psychologist, and I was a consultant at that time with financial planners, I saw a bunch of these people. They all looked like they had post-traumatic stress. I had previously done work in the VA in the Center for Post-Traumatic Stress. So I knew what that was like. And I'm like, they can't sleep. They can't eat. They're questioning their entire version of reality. And so I did a study, and sure enough, about 90% of them had symptoms of post-traumatic stress, to your point that it's much more intense for advisors who are working with people and they have employees, you know, and this is their entire business could be potentially a threat. And so I think, and that's part of that humility that your wife helped you attain. My wife does that for me too. Thank you. You're reminding me to be more humble, sometimes in a nice way. But I think it's super important, because it's a huge vulnerability for us. Yeah. And the more you know, the worse it is, the more vulnerable you are to this.
Yeah.
And so to not be too cocky is great advice.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. So from that, I would ascertain that, you know, although, I try to live this and I try to also portray this in my coaching and advising to aspiring financial advisors, is that you as a financial advisor are not necessarily there, I would say not at all there, to know all the answers. You're there to provide a sounding board for meaningful dialogue that will help the client get to their destination with less friction, essentially, right? So what that means is you usually have a team of people, right, that will support your enterprise and the platform of advice that you're giving. And so, with that framework, with that context, would you say that most consumers of financial services would need to have an advisor? Would that be your opinion, or like for the do-it-yourselfers out there, what caution would you give them?
Yeah, so that is my opinion, and of course I am biased since I am a financial planner, but I also, like I said, I also yield my own personal financial decisions. I run them by other financial planners because I know that I cannot be objective as much as I think I can be when it comes to my own money, my own resources, my own family. So anyway, I think it's very, very important. And by the way, I think that every therapist should have their own therapist too. So, and you know, every dentist should have their own dentist. Like you probably shouldn't try to do it yourself. You know, it's like, so I think it's the behavioral alpha that really comes into play. And part of what I think advisors do for clients, again, you might not know exactly how to get them, to beat the market every year or whatever. But a lot of it is helping clients not do dumb things, like not make stupid mistakes, and to help be there to coach them through the decision making process around business planning or investment planning. Obviously,
I totally agree. It's a game of errors. It's kind of like golf. It's you're trying to minimize errors. Essentially, that's how you get the highest score. So,
absolutely.
What would you say though is like, so what would you be some words of wisdom as we kind of wind this up, bring it in for a landing? What are some words of wisdom that you would give to, you know, someone that's looking to get into this career? What would you say are some of the core skill sets in the light of what we just talked about and kind of how you see this industry shaping? I know since you teach it, you're obviously getting people that are coming through that want to get into this field. And what are some of the things that you're sharing with them?
So the robo-advisor threat, okay, is a bit of an opportunity too. And I think what I've been seeing happening in this industry at the CFP level, board level, and it's trickling all the way down, is this real understanding that the value we provide clients is beyond just that focus on investment returns and portfolios. And it really comes down to that relationship we have with the client. To your point, it's about minimizing error. In order to do that, you need to have a good relationship with that client. You need to have good listening skills. You need to have an understanding of psychology, behavioral biases, the impact of what it was like for them growing up. You need to have that understanding, because the movement is more towards this sort of financial life advising and coaching model, where it's not just you sit down and you go over the portfolio once a year with a client. You're there as a trusted advisor to help them in every aspect of their financial life. And that's where you're going to provide the most value. And that's where you're going to have clients who never leave you.
I'm glad you said that. I got an inquiry, a DM on my YouTube channel, and someone asked me what three books would you advise for an aspiring financial advisor? And one of them was Life Planning by George Kinder. I was like, you need to be able to light the torch, as George says, for that client. And because that is going to be the most influence on their behavior you can ever have, which is what they think about it. That's the, you know, it's you think that you're giving all this advice, but essentially you're hoping to connect with something inside the client that they already agree with, because they're going to follow their advice more often than not. And so I'm glad you said that.
Yeah, I would add facilitating financial health to that list, and not just because I wrote it, but it's being used in like about 20 universities right now to train financial planners. And really what it actually teaches listening skills. And what do you do when a client is resisting advice? So it's basically taking the technology from psychology to help get a client moving in the right direction. Let's say they need a will, but they won't move forward on it. So what am I supposed to do as an advisor? And what you're seeing is, I think, more and more of this information from psychology finding its way into financial planning, which is fabulous, because every seasoned financial planner knows that this is an issue of humans and their behaviors.
God, you know it. You know it. Oh my gosh. Yeah. I mean, even to that point, and this is just kind of like a bonus. Like I partner with my alma mater, who they have a CFP board registered program, just gotten it this last fall. And, you know, of course, they're always looking for students. And you know this working for Creighton, that there's always this student grab for majors. And, you know, one of the things that the professor told me is that, you know, he's actually looking outside of the traditional business student, because the social sciences offers such a great palette and platform for people to get into the industry also. What would you say to that? I tend to agree with what he's saying.
I do too. And I wrote an article in the Journal of Financial Planning a while back, and I called it Financial Planner is Healer. Now, before you balk, let me sort of explain this. The number one stressor in the lives of Americans, 3 out of 4 Americans, is money.
Money.
Stress kills people. It kills people every day. So that's the thing that people are most stressed about. And who are they supposed to go see for that kind of help? and it's you, a financial planner. And so you have the a potential to be a healing influence in people's lives in an area that keeps them up at night, that they suffer around. And I feel like it's a huge opportunity for us to as a profession. So I can see exactly why your friend and colleague there is mentioning there's a lot that psychology, you know, therapy type, you know, skills have to offer to financial planning clients, many of whom are never going to go see someone else. So you're going to be the one there. And so if you have those skills, you can provide an incredible value, frankly, a life-saving value to clients.
Wow. I don't know that I can top that answer or with another question. So I think we'll just leave it there. Dr. Brad, man, appreciate you coming on today and sharing your wisdom with the audience.
My pleasure.
All right. We'll talk to you soon.
Take care.
Well, that wraps up this week's episode, and I hope you were able to glean at least one takeaway that will help you on your path. You know what? I'd really love to hear what it was that I said that may have helped you. Feel free to drop me an email at info@djh-capital.com. That's info@djh-capital.com. One last thing, my friend. It would really help the podcast if you would leave a review on the platform that you're enjoying it on. I'd really appreciate it, and it will help more financial professionals like yourself find out about what we're doing here. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.